Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the story behind the luminous Portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer by Gustav Klimt? The painting made headlines in 2006 when it was sold for a then-record $135 million to cosmetics heir and philanthropist Ronald Lauder. But its complicated history goes far deeper than that, from the cosmopolitan salons of turn-of-the-century Vienna to the clutches of Nazi art thieves eager to erase the painting's Jewish history, to a protracted legal fight to return the painting to the family that originally commissioned it, spearheaded by the octogenarian niece of Adele Bloch Bauer herself. Journalist Anne Marie O'Connor tells the fascinating story in her new book, The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer. Anne Marie, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you get to know Maria Altman, the niece of Adele Bloch Bauer, who would ultimately really take the lead position in fighting to reclaim this painting and four others?
You know, it was really an accident. I was reading a community newspaper one day in Los Angeles in 2001. And I noticed a little item about a local woman who was trying to get back a portrait of her aunt. Now, this was very common in Los Angeles in those days, and people had very little progress on these cases. Usually they tried a little bit and got tired and went away, and many of them were quite a bit older.
Mm-hmm.
So I read this item, and I looked at the postage stamp-sized image of the painting in this community newspaper. And I was astounded. It was one of the most recognizable paintings in the world.
Yeah.
So I called 411, and I got her number, and I drove over to her house, and she was this very elegant woman who was actually working, dressing a woman for a living at that time, and she was fitting her with a navy blue blazer. But she sat me down, my darling, my love, served me Viennese coffee with lots of whipped cream, and told me this amazing story about the painting and her aunt.
Hmm. What kinds of memories did she have, first of all, of her aunt, Adele Bauer?
Well, she remembered her aunt as a somewhat austere person, very intellectual, elegant, beautiful, with tremendous charisma, but not interested in children. And Maria was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had other things going on.
Well, she was this very brilliant salon host in Vienna at that time, which was a role that women were allowed to play in intellectual life.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't go to cafes. They were not particularly acceptable there. But they had salons in their homes, and they were able to host the ideas of Freud and the new art of Klimt in this way. And she was this brilliant salon host. She had lots of intellectuals and socialists and all kinds of interesting people, artists, came to her salon. And Maria saw her in that context as this kind of aloof, distant, very glamorous aunt who was had a tremendous impact in her society in Vienna at that time.
So, Anne-Marie, tell us a little bit about the cultural climate that existed in Vienna in the early 1900s with regard to the sort of unspoken rules that governed friendships and intermarriage and business dealings between Jews and Gentiles.
Well, you know, there was still a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism in Vienna at the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very anti-Semitic mayor, Karl Luger. But a lot of this emerging intelligentsia saw this anti-Semitism as background music. They had very glamorous lives. They had been freed from residency restrictions by the Jewish emancipation 50 years before. So now they were all living in Vienna. They were building palaces. They were patrons of the new art that was emerging of Gustav Klimt and Schiele and Kokoschka later. And they suddenly started to play a very central role. And these secular Jewish families, who were very intellectual, well-read, and brilliant, were immeasurably important to Klimt, in particular the women in these families.
And they often wanted to be painted by him.
portrait painted by Klimt in those days was very similar to having a Warhol portrait mm-hmm. painted of prominent American women. It was risque, but it was fabulous.
And Klimt was—he was certainly a character. Not only was he very fond of women, but he definitely sort of marched to the beat of his own drummer.
Gustav Klimt was from a very poor family. He was self-made. He worked his way up. He started art school when he was 14, and he worked his way up through his own merits, painting decorative art in palaces and spas with his brother. To these women, he became something of a central figure because he took their aspirations seriously. He seemed to take women who were emerging as players in those days more seriously than many of the other men who were in public life at that time. And they began to gravitate towards him as patrons.
And talk a little bit about the things that inspired him during the what's called the gold period. First of all, I thought it was interesting that his father was a gold engraver. So this was like the color gold and this fabulous material was something he had grown up seeing.
That's right. Everything that glittered in Vienna in those days was gold or at least gilt. Mm-hmm. Gold was the color of the Habsburg Empire. It was the color of power. Before that, it was the color of transcendence and immortality in religious art and Byzantine art, which inspired some of his paintings. For Klimt, gold was something that adorned many of these palaces that he worked with, but he used it in a very different way. He used it also as transcendence and a type of immortality. But for him, those qualities were very closely linked to sensuality. So it is no coincidence that his most sensual, rich paintings use a tremendous amount of gold. Hmm.
And what's really fascinating is when you look really closely at many of these paintings, including the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, certainly her skin is beautiful and she looks very attractive, and yet she's maybe not as beautiful as we believe her to be because of this setting she's placed in.
Well, you know, some people interpreted that setting as a gilded cage, that she was this sort of free spirit who was trapped in the hidebound still traditions of her time and yearning to emancipate herself and break out, as many people were in those days, because many new ideas were coming out about psychology and art and music, and people were trying to break out of the established molds and ways of seeing the world that were false or not honest. So some people interpreted that background with that process. But for Klimt, he had somewhat copied the Byzantine icons that he saw in Italy. Mm-hmm. So he also had another inspiration for what art critics of the time would call his painted mosaic style.
How did Adele end up married to Ferdinand Bloch?
She was very young. Girls were very protected in those days, and really arranged marriages existed right up to Maria Altman's time. Marriages were arranged by families, and girls were very sheltered. Now, she had a very good friend who would be the wife of Gustav Mahler, Alma Mahler. Mm-hmm. Her family gave her a lot of freedom and allowed her to meet alone with men and have her own kind of encounters. But Adele was very sheltered, and she was still a teenager when she met Ferdinand. She grew up in sort of a hothouse environment where people read poetry at family gatherings, and her sister had married Ferdinand's brother.
Mm. So did she love her husband?
I think she, judging from what people said and the written record, she respected him. And he was a good man, and later he would emerge during right before World War II as something of a hero. Mm-hmm. But when she met him, she wanted to collect modern art, and he wanted to collect porcelain, which he did. And he collected very traditional art. So it wasn't so much that he was a good man, but he wasn't as exciting as her. And I think that the older she got and the more autonomous she became, the more that schism developed between them, where she married him and respected him, but did not seem to be passionately in love with him at all.
And there was a pretty significant age difference.
Yes, he was twice her age when they got married.
Mm-hmm. But he was okay with her commissioning this portrait, and this would involve a series of sittings over a number of years for Klimt.
Yes, for 3 years. Klimt did another portrait of her later that ended had them spending a total of 9 years together. So they spent nearly a decade together on a very regular basis. And there is an erotic drawing of someone who looks very similar to Adele that has surfaced in Klimt's work that has made people speculate about what actually happened during those 9 years. But Ferdinand, like many of these interesting men of that time who were emerging, these were not the old aristocrats in Vienna. These were newcomers. And they were also very receptive to some of this new art. And for this group of people, having a Klimt portrait of your wife or daughter was very prestigious, in spite of all the what had been said about Klimt's reputation at that time.
It was somewhat scandalous.
His reputation was scandalous. Some people, particularly the more established aristocrats, were very reluctant to have their daughters painted by Klimt because they were afraid to have him spend that much time alone with these young women, particularly if they were not married and maidens. They were worried it would affect their reputation. Adele was married at this time. But yes, she would have spent a lot of time alone with Klimt during the period of his life when he was most seductive. Hmm. When this portrait began, Gustav Klimt was something of a sex symbol in Vienna. He was very talented. He was a star in a city in which art was power. He was a bit of a god. And so in this particular time, there are many backstories of his seductions in those days of some prominent women and also some sort of encounters with women like Alma Mahler. So, yes, this was, I suppose it was a bit of a risk. It was, but Ferdinand went ahead with it.
So the original portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer was completed in 1907. Talk about the reception.
Well, you know, it was first exhibited in Germany, but it was really when it was exhibited in Vienna that it made a huge splash. It just made her a celebrity. People compared it to religious icons. They called Adele an idol in a golden shrine. This portrait really put her on the map, which is where she wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
She was eager for prominence, and she wanted to identify herself with this new sort of existentialist movement of artists, and she did.
My guest is journalist Anne-Marie O'Connor. She writes for The Washington Post from Mexico City. We're talking this hour about her new book, The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. If you want to send email just for today, send it to thinkkera@gmail.com. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Anne-Marie O'Connor, a journalist who writes for The Washington Post. Her new book is called The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email just for today to thinkkera@gmail.com. So I want to go back to the story of Adele. We will be fast-forwarding through time here, obviously, to get up to the 21st century. But Anne-Marie, she died quite young, but had left some instructions about what she wanted done with the Klimt paintings that the family had commissioned.
Yes, she died at 43 in 1925. At that time, she was very immersed in a project to make the National Art Gallery, the Belvedere today, a showcase of modern art, and Klimt and Schiele and all of these artists were among the people that she was trying to promote with the director of the gallery so that it was truly a showcase for Vienna's modern art, not just Baroque and historic art. And as part of this, she wanted her husband to, after his death, give the paintings by Klimt that they owned at that time to the art museum. Now, these paintings were, in all likelihood, it was later determined they were bought by him. Mm-hmm. So they were his property. But this was a request that she made a couple years before her death. And it was made in this spirit that she wanted to participate in the re-energizing of the National Gallery.
But this request that she made came, I guess it was written down at least in 1923, 15 years before Germany annexed Austria. She couldn't have imagined what was coming.
Yes, that is correct. And if she wanted to be part of the new Austria, perhaps the Austria that came to be was not something she would have wanted to be part of.
Mm-hmm.
But jurists would later determine that Ferdinand was the owner of these paintings, and it was up to him to make this request a reality. But he was never able to fulfill it in the manner that she asked for, because in 1938, Hitler marched into Vienna. They took over their palace in Vienna on Elisabethstrasse, and art museum directors under the new Nazi regime came and divided up his art. Now, some of his art went to the new Führer Museum in Linz for Hitler, for a special museum he was going to make. The Klimt paintings were of the least interest to the Nazis, because Klimt was still considered a little too modern by them, and he was known to be a philo-Semite. In other words, he was known to be a very good friend of Jewish Viennese citizens. So they did not immediately go after his paintings, but some of the Austrian museum directors, the new Nazi directors of the museums, because they had replaced the other directors, were very interested in these paintings, and they came over to these meetings, which were attended by the Gestapo, and at this point Ferdinand was not dead, and this was not a probate, so this was not done under the terms of Adele's bequest, and they, some of them spotted these Klimt paintings and wanted them for the National Art Museum.
So how did the Nazis deal with the, air quotes here, problem of the fact that this extraordinary work, and in fact several extraordinary works, had a very deep link to Jewish Vienna?
Well, Baldur von Schirach, who was head of the Hitler Youth, was made governor of Vienna. Baldur von Schirach decided to, the Nazi governor, he decided to create the biggest art show ever of Gustav Klimt. Now, he was a big admirer of Klimt's work, and he was willing to overlook a lot of details about Klimt that weren't entirely in keeping with Nazi ideology, because Klimt could be cast as an übermensch, a very masculine, handsome, virile German man. There were some Klimt paintings scattered throughout Vienna at that time. Some of them had surfaced in the museums. These were all stolen paintings from collections by Jewish patrons. In 1941, the painting of Adele Bloch Bauer came to the Belvedere, and a book came out that noted the new acquisition, and they had a picture of the painting. The book was written by an old friend of Klimt's who had now embraced the Nazi era, and the book simply referred to this brilliant painting that was acquired by the National Gallery as Dame in Gold, the Lady in Gold. And that's what the Nazis did with these portraits of these brilliant Jewish women who had helped Klimt become the artist that he was. They changed their names, they rendered them anonymous, and they put them in this enormous Klimt art show, which is the biggest art show of Klimt's work that could ever be held. And they gave all the Jewish women anonymous names so that they could be showcased as sophisticated Viennese society women during the Nazi era.
So Ferdinand Bloch essentially lost most of his wealth, but he was able to ride out the war in Switzerland, but died soon after. Is that correct?
Yes, he fled. Like many people, but he fled in a timely fashion, and he was able to survive. And he lived in Switzerland. By the time he died, he was broke. He was staying in a luxury hotel, but Swiss authorities in those days kind of cashed in on refugees by assigning them to stay in very expensive hotels because there was very little tourism in those days.
So other parts of the family who were able to survive scattered to other parts of the world, including Adele's niece that we referred to at the top of the hour, Maria Altman. And her story and her husband's story is really extraordinary.
Yes. Maria was able to escape. Her husband was sent to Dachau. They endured an agonizing wait to find out what his fate might be. And Maria was able to escape Austria and later come back to demand these paintings. Her sister, Luisa, was not quite as lucky. Luisa stayed in Yugoslavia, and the Germans eventually invaded there as well. And she and her husband and her two children were trapped there. And they survived the Holocaust in Yugoslavia and endured a terrifying nightmarish ordeal there.
And before Maria's husband was released from Dachau, and we'll explain how that happened in a moment, but there was this sort of sweet and yet agonizing correspondence back and forth between the two in which they couldn't really refer to what was taking place because they knew that their letters were being censored.
Yes, they wrote this very, very romantic exchange of letters. It went on for months, and they had just been married. They'd just been back from their honeymoon for 11 days when Hitler came, and Fritz was arrested and eventually sent to Dachau shortly thereafter. Obviously, censors read those letters, but there was a lot of attempt on both their parts to avoid worrying the other when. Worrisome things happened in Maria's family life. She simply didn't tell Fritz, and some of the things he found out in the newspaper. But they began this very romantic, tender exchange that was really one of the most romantic parts of their marriage in spite of the circumstances, and really told a lot about human resilience and the capacity to use faith to survive in the most difficult of circumstances.
So how were they able to get Fritz out?
Well, what happened with a lot of the families of their social class, and this would come into play with the art patrons of Klimt, who were from this class and part of this social milieu, what happened was they used members of the family as hostages. They would... If some members of the family had escaped, they would focus on family members who they could imprison. For example, in Yugoslavia, Maria's sister, Luisa, and her children were hostages for her husband to try to extract resources from her husband. So in this case, Fritz was the perfect hostage. He'd just come back from his honeymoon. His wife was very much in love with him. His family was very eager to get him out, and they would do anything. And they, for months, they tried everything to release him. And this was an astute calculation on the part of the authorities. What they had not counted on was his brother, Bernhard, who was older, very savvy, and very tough. And Bernhard had escaped right away when Hitler came. And he was the one who negotiated Fritz's release. And he was a tough customer, and he managed to outwit them.
So Fritz and Maria ultimately made their way to California and made a life there.
Yes, they had a very happy life, a very uneventful life for many, many years. I think Maria felt like all the great dramas of her life were behind her by the time she was in her 80s.
Had she given much thought to the painting? Did she remember it throughout all this time?
You know, what Maria remembered, she remembered the paintings, but she remembered the entire era. The era of that she lived before the war in Vienna was very romantic, a very lovely time. People have very fond memories of old Vienna and always spoke about it in very nostalgic terms, even today in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And she was no different. It was all part and parcel. I think that what was most galling about that painting and other paintings for many of these Jewish families is they were not hidden away in castles or in a closet or in a cave somewhere. They were on museum walls. And it was very brazen that a lot of this stolen property was kept there. Now, not all the families knew that this had been stolen, because when they went and tried to claim some of their family's property, they were told that these paintings were donated, the Rothschilds and many other families. And often it was the heirs and younger people. And the Austrians simply told them, these paintings were donated, they don't belong to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for Maria, when she found out that the paintings had actually were not donated voluntarily, and Ferdinand had been trying to get them back at the time of his death, I think that she was outraged, but it wasn't just an outrage about a painting or a group of paintings. It was an outrage about everything, because a lot of Viennese refugees felt that they had never really experienced contrition for what had happened to them and their families. And they had suffered terribly, but in the cases of Maria and many other people, they'd gone on to make wonderful lives. But I think that when she found out that there had been a deception behind the seizure of these paintings, it suddenly inspired in her this tremendous cause at the end of her life.
It really is huge to think about taking on a fight this big. This wasn't even simply a fight with the museum. This was a fight with the Austrian government, which was very much behind the Belvedere in trying to hang on to this painting and these paintings and keep them where they were.
Yes. You know, in many ways, this was the first big case. Since then, Austrian museums have had to return a dozen paintings by Gustav Klimt, major masterpieces that have sold for a lot of money. The Belvedere has had to return 10. I think that when this began and Maria started this cause, it really wasn't just about the restitution of a painting. It was about a restitution of history.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversations that took place on both sides were very much about whether this was a Holocaust case, with the Austrians saying, this doesn't have anything to do with the Holocaust, it's about a will. And with the families, with Maria and other families saying, no, this is all about the Holocaust, mm-hmm. and about how we were dispossessed. And these paintings are symbols of the unaddressed wrongs of Austria.
I'm curious, Anne-Marie, about the kinds of conversations that took place within Austria, not at the levels of high-ranking government, but among regular people who might have been following these stories in the newspapers.
Well, you know, it was very powerful there culturally, because for the older generation, it was a little disturbing. Some of them remembered the Nazi era, although that generation is passing on. but some of them remembered it, and these symbols, these paintings were very familiar to them, and they became sort of Freudian symbols of everything that had happened and things that they hadn't wanted to think about for years. For the younger generation, it provoked a lot of curiosity. They had always heard stories about what their father and their grandfather did during the war. And now they wanted to know more, or they wanted to know if the stories that they had heard were true. And one of these people was a young journalist called Hubertus Czernin, who was a count. And he, like other Austrians, he had heard that Kurt Waldheim had spent the war years at university. But then he heard some other stories that he wasn't at university, and he published an expose showing that Kurt Waldheim actually joined the German army and in a Nazi organization and traveled throughout the former empire in the army. And according to one Yugoslavian archive, he should have been tried as a war criminal. Now, this was a representative of the generation of Austrians that were really curious about this and wanting to know more. The next thing that Hubertus took on after his expose of Kurt Waldheim, which had huge repercussions, was he started to look into the backgrounds of these paintings that were in national museums. He started to try to gain access to these locked archives of paintings like the portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer.
My guest is journalist Anne Marie O'Connor. She writes for The Washington Post and is the author of the new book, The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email today to thinkkera@gmail.com.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Washington Post journalist Anne Marie O'Connor. Her new book is called The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or emailing thinkkera@gmail.com. So, Anne Marie, Maria Altman decides she wants to take up this fight. In order to do it effectively, she needs a brilliant and really dedicated lawyer, and boy, does she find one.
Well, when I first met her, I was thinking, what legal Houdini could possibly get around all of the obstacles in this case? These paintings are in a foreign country. How do you bring them over? How do you establish jurisdiction? And I asked her who her lawyer was, and she said, Randy, I've known him since he was in diapers. It turned out to be the grandson of one of her best friends. He was a grandson of a famous composer, Arnold Schoenberg, who had been declared a degenerate during the Nazi era. And he was very young. I went over to his office, and he looked like he had just graduated from college, although he was probably he was in his early 30s at that time. Mm-hmm. And he was very erudite. He had books all over his office about art and history and also legal tomes, philosophy, everything. And he spread out all the photographs in the case like a Russian novel and just told amazing stories about all these characters. What impressed me the most about the case wasn't the idea that they could win, because I didn't think they could, and most people, most legal analysts, didn't think so either. What impressed me was how astoundingly rich the story was and how connected this family was with so many of the important intellectuals and artists of their age. So my feeling about the story, I was at the Los Angeles Times at that time, was, you know, to my editors, this is a great story. I don't really think this case is going to go anywhere, but it's just an amazing story. And yes, Randall was absolutely relentless. No one worked harder. He was convinced he was right, and he had a lot of support, but no one worked harder than Randall. He didn't at that time have staff. He had left a large law firm to pursue this case. He had a little office in someone else's law firm, and he just pursued this to the end.
We have an email here from Margarita who asks what you thought about the movie Klimt by Raul Ruiz based on what you've studied of Viennese society.
Well, you know, they tried. I would say they tried. I went to the premiere, and John Malkovich was at the premiere. And, of course, he was, that was the week that Randall went to go look at the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer and to inspect it, to have it returned. So Malkovich got asked a lot of questions about that because it was topical. It was the first really major high-profile restitution of that stature. So I would say the movie, I didn't think it was a great movie. But I think that they made an attempt to have that era. The interesting thing about that movie was a lot of Austrian cultural officials stood up and talked about the cultural figures who were in that movie, who were friends of Adele Bloch-Bauer's, the woman in the painting. But again, as is very common in Austria, they neglected to tell what had happened to these women when the Nazis marched in, because these women were Jewish, a lot of the women portrayed in this movie. And they were very interesting intellectuals of that time. But the movie was presented without that context by Austrian officials of that time, which I found a very strange part of that evening.
So what was the break in the case? I mean, Schoenberg obviously was sort of plugging away at this and going level after level and having to keep all these plates spinning. Talk about how procedurally they made this happen.
Well, I think that Randall always said all along that if people would just look at the facts of the case, he would win. But his early legal battles were not about the facts. They were about establishing jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Why was the U.S. the proper jurisdiction for this lawsuit? He kept saying that it was, and he kept winning in lower courts. Now, he said that he established jurisdiction by the fact that these paintings were stolen in violation of international law, and also that there was some commercial activity going on with these paintings, which I guess would be sort of loosely translated as trafficking in stolen property. He made it all the way to the Supreme Court. The Austrians appealed to the Supreme Court saying that even if U.S. law allowed this case to be tried in the U.S., under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, it was improper to apply the 1976 Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act retroactively to events that occurred in the 1940s because this law had not been codified at that time. So he got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that this law could be applied retroactively, that it was simply a tool, and it wasn't limited to a certain historical period. And this painted the Austrians into a corner. This was a very dramatic difficulty for them because they could keep appealing and keep appealing, but this legal battle had been going on for years. It went on for 8 years. Every step of the way, even though the battle was not about the actual merits of the case, the history was told and retold. And Maria Altman, a woman of tremendous dignity and charm and a wonderful storyteller, came out and told what happened to her family in Austria. And other people were listening to this case and starting to look into their paintings. So this case was really snowballing in an unpleasant way. I mean, I guess in Americans would call it a PR disaster. It was a PR disaster.
Is it fair to say it opened the floodgates for other families in a similar situation?
I would say so, and not just in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
But so the Austrians offered to resolve this in Austria. And this was a huge gamble for Randall to allow an Austrian panel decide this case.
Sure.
But it was the first time it would be decided based on the merits, which is what he had wanted all along. So a panel of three Austrian jurists sat down and spent months looking over the circumstances of this case. And it was a huge gamble for Randall. Maria thought he was crazy to try, but she went along with it, and eventually they released their decision, and they decided the paintings did not belong to Austria. They would go back to the family.
So they go to the family. I mean, for people who aren't aware of this already, Maria Altman was living a fully middle-class lifestyle. She was not in a mansion somewhere. And so there's this decision about what's to be done with these works.
I think that, in many ways, was the most difficult part of all. Up until that moment, it was a romantic crusade, a tremendously inspiring story. And suddenly, they were faced with something they had never counted on. They were given the paintings back.
Yeah.
There were five paintings. They had not counted on this, and they had to decide what to do. And by that time, there were five heirs. Some of them were very young. They had very little connection to Austria. Only two people had actually lived through the Holocaust, Maria Altman and her niece, who had lived in Yugoslavia, Nellie Auersperg. Nellie was a very accomplished woman. She was a world-known cancer specialist in ovarian cancer, a very smart woman. The family did not agree on even whether to bring them out of Austria. Nellie would have liked them to stay there. Maria felt very strongly that they should come to the United States, but that they possibly some of them would be put on public view. Now, they had a very successful outcome on this with the Neue Gallery's purchase of the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, which is still on public view and is a symbol of everything that has happened. But they weren't able to do this with all the paintings, and this is very common in these cases of art restitution. Very few of these paintings are not sold. They're generally sold at auction because there's too many heirs and they can't decide. And in this case, it broke down along those lines, where not everybody was happy about the outcome,
mm-hmm.
the paintings being sold at auction, but that's what happened. And they were taken; most of them were taken out of public view.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, heartbreaking on its own, you know, for its own reasons, certainly. And obviously, there were also, I mean, Maria Altman would have had tremendous legal bills by the time this was all over.
Yeah, they had tremendous costs. They also owed commissions and, you know, there were other complications. They really, if they had wanted to make a donation or have some of them pre-sold, like the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer before auction, they would have had to come together and make a joint decision, or they would have had to pay off the other heirs.
Mm-hmm.
So it boiled down to mathematics. So that part was really a little bit bittersweet, but common. This is what happens to these paintings often when they're restituted, and I think that it would be better for these museums to sort of get in ahead of time and perhaps make deals that would keep these paintings in the museums, because the only alternative to this kind of restitution, which is very, very new, is keeping stolen property hanging on museum walls.
Yeah.
And that's no longer acceptable
mm-hmm.
to the public opinion.
And I guess the issue that's been raised is that in most cases, very few museums are able to pay market prices for these works.
No, but I think in some cases, there if there is some kind of consensus, they might be able to have a deal that does not involve market prices. For example, early on, there was some discussion that Maria had in Austria about leaving the portraits of Adele Bloch-Bauer, the two portraits
mm-hmm.
in Austria, and then taking the three landscapes out. That would have been a good resolution. They could have done what they wish with the landscapes and left the portraits there, which Austrians considered their patrimony, so much so that when Austria recently issued a coin to commemorate the 150th anniversary of Klimt's birth this year, they put the portrait of Adele on one side of the first coin. So this was a very important painting for them. And later, some Austrian officials expressed regret that they had not been more proactive and just tried to come to grips with this sooner.
So, Anne-Marie, what does this story tell us about where we are on both sides of the Atlantic in terms of acknowledging, processing, making reparations for the Holocaust?
Well, you know, in the old days, 20% of the art of Europe was stolen during the Holocaust. Thousands of paintings are still outstanding. In the old days, treasures were seen as the booty of war. These paintings were indictments to some degree because they were paintings of women who in some cases had been persecuted or their families had been persecuted who collected these paintings. They had a tremendously powerful moral force, these paintings, and many of Klimt's works because of this history. So I think the world is becoming a much smaller place for things like looted art. This art was stolen in furtherance of a great crime, a crime that shocks people, will always shock people. It no longer was acceptable to have this kind of stolen property on museum walls. And I think that in the end, that trumped concerns over patrimony. There had to be some atonement, some contrition, some show of regret. And these paintings had to be returned. Now, paintings that are as important as these paintings are sold every night at Christie's, and it's important to realize that great art, owning a great work of art, is a privilege, and people have to decide if it involves a duty to display it, and the new owners of the paintings can make that choice themselves. But I think that what was no longer acceptable was having these paintings hanging on museum walls as symbols of the unaddressed wrongs of the past.
Journalist Anne-Marie O'Connor writes for The Washington Post from Mexico City, where she makes her home. Her new book is called The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. Anne-Marie, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.